I'm just glad to have the opportunity to sit down with you for a few minutes and talk about a heck of a story, your life, in a big portion of it. So you have literally made me lose sleep the last three nights.
Why?
Well, because, you know, the moment that we decided that we were going to record together,
yeah,
I plunged myself into learning as much as I could about the case, or about how prolific this creature, for lack of a better term, you know, was during the times that he was doing, you know, his crimes, which was a very long time.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is the fact that I have an odd, and I don't think I'm different than a lot of people, that I have this odd obsession with minds like that. And so from Mindhunter that just came on Netflix to Criminal Minds to anything that has to do with serial killers, I have a fascination with it. But I take it in spurts. I'll watch something, it'll get very heavy, I'll put it on pause, won't come back to it for 3 months, and then pick back up to it. Since you and I decided to record, I have basically been watching documentaries, YouTube, up as much on the case as possible. And I think it just got to my head to the point where I was having nightmares.
I'm so sorry. I totally understand it. I'm so sorry.
You know, and to a certain degree, Jen, I feel like, oh my gosh, I am dealing with this with so much distance both in time and relativity from what has actually happened. Never mind the fact that you have lived through this and you have experienced it, are experiencing, are writing, you know, about it, and it's still not resolved to a certain degree.
Right.
So, like I said, I find that fascinating. But like I said, at the same time, for me, I think I just went into the deep end. And I lost a few Z's here and there. So again, it's all first world problems on my side, but I wanted to let you know that shame on you for
I was gonna say, and who among us has not done what you did?
No, has kidding.
Not suffered the consequences.
So I'll take a second to properly introduce, you know, a little bit about you and whatnot, but I'll just give you a quick story. Like I said, I have had some obsessions here and there. I did not know about this case at all. I mean, I live within 2 miles, I think, of a home that Richard Ramirez, the
Yes. Are you there? No, that's weird.
Things in, they open up the listing because every now and then it goes up for sale and everybody knows that's a Night Stalker house and morbid curiosity tells you, you got to go up there, you got to take a look. There's nothing to see. But we as real estate agents have to disclose. And in to the fact that I have a place 2 miles away from me, it's always been kind of creepy. But as I've been reading more about what's been going on, I understand that now that the person who is the serial killer that we're going to be talking about today, that he was considered at one point, at least according to the Wikipedia articles that I've been reading, he was considered the original Night Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's those kind of weird connections that happen where all of a sudden you realize, oh, this guy's connected to me, you know, by a few degrees of separation. It makes it a heck of a lot more chilling. In addition to that, I was watching a documentary on Hulu about it. And it's a documentary, I think, that was made prior to him being captured. And so there's a lot of conjecture and a lot of, you know, 1990s drama attached to it. It's like, oh, you know, citizen sleuths are going to get them and all of that. And it's odd to see these people go through a manhunt on their own, knowing what the outcome is, which is the fact that he is now caught and going through the trial system. So it's just these very interesting cross sections of where the little stuff that I know about history, coming to a head with new things that I'm learning. So that's all to say that I have been very interested in talking to you for a while, and I'm glad that after many months of back and forth and schedules and whatnot, that I have the opportunity. So with that being said, Jen, and I think it's okay to call you Jen because you said that on your website, if you could introduce yourself to the crowd that's listening, and then we'll start asking questions and go from there.
Love it. My name is Jennifer Carroll. It used to be Jennifer Carroll Smith, or Jenny Smith, as I'm known in Ventura, California. My dad is Lyman Smith, and my stepmother was Charlene Smith, who were both murdered, in, as it turned out, by the Golden State Killer. And that was in 1980 when I was but a wee child of 18. And so now everybody knows, yep, I'm 57 now. There's no hiding my age. It's out there.
Sure. But, no secrets there.
Yeah. And so I'm super happy to speak with you today about my experiences, the crime, and anything else that comes up.
So there's a line in your website, jcarroll.com, and I'll have the show notes later on with the links to that. But it, one of the values, the fifth one that you have this written out, and I quote, "Justice is derived by principle, not by authority. Sometimes doing the wrong thing is the right thing to do," end quote. And I guess I want to begin with, how did you derive at that value for yourself, and how and what does it mean in relation to what you do on the everyday, but also mm-hmm. as how it relates in the sense of you are now seeing, you know, a court case in a procedure, you know, with regards to, you know, hopefully ending this drama, if there is such a thing as an ending to it.
Yes, right. It's such, so this is a, it's a concept I encourage people to think about, because even in these times in America today, like just looking at our current situation as Americans, justice isn't something that it's not a something you can give someone. Justice is what is right. And sometimes being just means doing the wrong thing. So I use that as a principle, and I have to say I learned that from my parents, both of them, my dad being a lawyer and my mom being just a remarkably centered, she was raised by two Minnesotans. So I always say, yep, that Minnesota value came through, but she was born here in California. But my parents, both of them were about doing the right thing and being just, and my dad taught us to fight for that. And as young, I'm not a lawyer, but I was raised by a lawyer. It's and that's why I use the lawyer's daughter.
His daughter, yeah,
yeah. Because I think I was arguing my case maybe somewhere around 3 or 4 years old. My dad would engage me in debate on everything, and typically he would need to win, which I figured out as an adult that was his MO, is that, you know, the adult would win. I'm like, of course you would. You're the parent. You always win. The parents win. There's no point to be in a power struggle with your kids. Parents get to win. So, but it made me really good at looking at all angles of a situation and being able to look at the information more from the idea of truth, not true, but truth. Like, what is really true about this situation? And as a result, my dad raised a fighter. I fight the just causes a lot. And I did growing up. That's, people would have told you that Jenny Smith was, would argue you to death. So even as we go through this case, we might not get justice in the way that, in a conventional way. But as far as I'm concerned, because the DNA found in my stepmother, and it's, that is the DNA, that was the match. And I was told it is a 100% match, because of that. Right. I feel like we already have justice. We know who did it. Yeah, go ahead.
So there is that certainty, not as far as the courts are concerned, but to as far as the science is concerned, you have that for yourself.
Absolutely.
But, you know, but from the standpoint of justice, one of the things that I found interesting as I was researching this, and mind you, that I know for a fact that you're a heck of a lot more studied about this, because obviously you lived it, but, you know, and I'm a new person looking at eyes, but from my understanding of it is that the statute of limitations on a lot of the older cases has come and gone. And so whatever charges have been filed against this person, they are for newer crimes, for lack of better terms. And so as far as the justice system, am I correct that there's some people that will not be, they'll not get the justice that perhaps they deserve as far as him getting time or punishment for things that happen?
Well, so if you want, so that's an authoritative definition of justice, right? That if you think of it from a authoritative reasoning, the bad guys get punished.
Sure.
The reality is, I think it is true that there are many of the rapes
that happened way before, so long ago that the statute of limitations has run out. So the Sacramento in particular chose to pursue cases that they could with a kidnapping charge, because he often moved the victim from one location to another. And this can be from the bedroom to the living room, just so we're clear. But sure. In that case, he had control over another person's agency or power to move their own body. So that was considered kidnapping. So those charges are being pursued. And then, of course, anything that has to do with murder does not, we don't have to worry about the statute of limitations. And rape rape while committing a murder is also considered then a crime that doesn't fit the statute of limitations.
Okay.
So now, you brought up something really interesting to me, because now I've spent a lot of time with the victims, which has absolutely been one of the best silver linings on this whole thing. I would say that for the most part, there are very few of the victims that want revenge. That's just not who they are. And that's actually why I've been so attracted to them. Because again, that's an authoritative model. In fact, you know, he's been caught. We have him. He's being held accountable. But in many ways, we've received justice because rape laws have changed and DNA is being looked at as a way to solve crimes, and their voices are being heard. And we've changed how we investigate rapes. There's a I wish I should know the name of the show, but there's a show about these two women who investigated a series of rapes, who came together and talked to the women differently than the men did. I think it's on Netflix. It's fantastic, with Toni Collette. So anybody out there, you know what this one is, go look up Toni Collette. She's sure. in it. But the idea is that if you want to be black and white and think that justice requires a beheading or an eye for an eye, you're likely not to go through life very satisfied. But if you okay. think about justice as moving humanity forward, and us finding our better selves and us being able to rise from the ashes of despair or trauma, then I think we've had a lot of justice.
So in what ways specifically would you say that the case has been consequential? Because you made a mention about the you know, rape laws have changed, or perhaps the way that we process rape, the way that we take rape seriously to some degree. Like, how has this case been consequential to that entire discussion?
Well, that's a really good question. I might need to write about that, because I think that's a fair question, and I'm not sure if I have the best answer sure. yet. But I could go back and take a look. I have a chance to talk a lot. I'm friends now with Carol Daly, who is one of the lead investigators. She worked her way into the job, started off as a typist, and became one of the lead investigators of the rapes in Northern California. And mind you, I didn't even know about these rapes until the early 2000s. So that's how separate our crime was from the what people today now see as the whole. This didn't start out as a whole. It started out as different pieces in different places, with Sacramento right. maybe having the most momentum because they had a serial rapist on the loose. So the community up there was terrorized. But in Southern California, we didn't experience like that. So when you think about the outcomes, I know, sorry, it's fun to talk about, right? Get all excited. I have the next question. But just, I was just going to finish that when it comes to the outcomes of this case, absolutely, from talking with Carol, I understand that the way in Sacramento that they started pursuing these rape cases evolved and evolved fairly rapidly, so that they could, so women weren't left additionally victimized by the crime. So they started to get their voices and started to be able to own their experiences, and not just told so many of them, because we're talking about in the 70s, we're told, are you feeling better now? It's been a week. I burned the nightgown that you were wearing when he raped you. Is that good? People, support systems didn't even know how to support the women. So right. there's so much we've changed over time, which, again, to me, that's gratifying. That's in a very meta way, justice.
That's very on point with regards to Carol. And I'm going to attribute, I'm going to paraphrase, I think, something that she said, which I thought was very interesting. If I remember one of the documentaries that I read, she was she held a press conference, and she might have held several, but the one mm-hmm. that they allude to in the video is that she was at a press conference, and two things that I thought were very interesting. Number one, she said something to the effect, and again, it could be somebody else, but I'm pretty sure of ladies, we are taught to be meek, to be polite, to be, you know, to be nice. Mm-hmm. But if somebody comes and, you know, attacks you, and again, I'm paraphrasing badly. She goes, you cannot just hurt this person. You need to immobilize, or you need to make sure that this person can't come at you, that, you know, you engage, because people were arming themselves, that you need to make sure that that person is not going to come after you've angered them. And I thought it was such a important permission to a certain degree at that point in time of to saying, hey, listen, you all are a community and you have a predator in your midst, and you need to make sure that you're not doing the nice thing, that you're out there actually protecting yourself. No, again, I think that was Carol. I could be wrong about that.
I think you're right.
And I thought it was a very empowering message. And then to a second degree, which I think is what was most chilling about that entire thing, is I believe that there was a gentleman at one of these press conferences who stood up and said, well, you know, obviously everything that has happened has happened because it wasn't a man in the house. And soon after that, he started attacking households in where the male was in the place. Again, I could have my facts wrong on that. But just the thought in the documentary where they said that he was probably in the room, he was probably assessing the situation. And that was part of the reason why he was so able to get away with it for such a long period of time. Anyways, I don't know if you and Carol have ever had conversations. My question is, have you and her ever had conversations about her own personal safety during this whole thing?
I haven't talked to her about her own personal safety, but if you meet her, she has such a strong sense of purpose. Sure. And a strong belief. She believes in the divine. She's a very religious woman, which I actually surprised me a little bit when I first met her, because I thought I knew she had a strong foundation. But she is so centered in who she is and what her values are that I don't think she would be afraid. And if she was, she would believe that she could handle it, because she is just that centered of a human and the kindest woman that you've ever met. I mean, she's just, I can imagine as she started to question women, as they moved away from the male investigators to letting Carol handle it, just her her presence is reassuring because of her sense of self and her own personal, how well she knows herself, that you would feel that you would trust her almost instantly. That is how powerful she is in her own self.
Yeah. Like I said, there's many things that stand out as I read more about this, but I think her demeanor, during the at least from the video that's available from those times, is of somebody who is who's very resolved, who understands the enormity of what's going on. I think she's definitely a very important person, and part of the reason why, you know, the investigation continued and the pieces started interlocking at one point, because she kept on at it.
And let me just add, for listeners who want to understand what this evolution was and how you question women and rape, often at the beginning, back when it was, when you think about crime and men being our law enforcement, data shared between people was typically transactional. How tall was he? He was this tall. What was he wearing? It was like this. Now for women, anybody who's even had been in touch and related to a woman knows, that's not really how we see the world. It's part of how we see the world, but we also take in a lot of the nuance or the meaning. And you see this even if you watch SVU. They ask you now to tell the story. And what did you smell? And recall by sense. What were your sense memories? Did you hear something? Did you smell something? Did you touch and notice that the skin was really dry? That's what Carol started to bring to the questioning, so that the women could tell it more as a story instead of this transactional Q&A that is often disruptive. I mean, this is one of the beautiful things about having a really good way of having integrated thinking, is you do notice all of it. And that really does tell more of the story and help them build a better understanding of who would eventually become our suspect, Joseph DeAngelo.
Wow. there's quite a lot there. And, you know, it's interesting. Just before I got on the phone with you, I was walking through a part of town and I noticed a man wearing no shoes, no shirt, pajama pants. This is and just walking through our train tracks and across one of our main thoroughways. And I wasn't concerned that he was a danger to anybody. I just was concerned that he was endangering himself. Mm-hmm. So I called the police, our local police department, and I gave them a description. And the reason why I bring this up is because it made sense to me from the standpoint of when I was talking to the police, I was able to describe he's going east on this street. He's wearing certain pants, a certain color. He has no shirt. He has no shoes. He's walking through traffic. His hair is disheveled. He's probably in his mid-60s, white person. And I give these very factual descriptions because mm-hmm. that's the way I go about it. I wanted to make you the play, the where, the when, the who, and why. Whereas perhaps if somebody, if you were making the phone call, there might be, there's just the different ways that we go about providing information. I think there was a time when we just thought, well, you just asked everybody the same way because, hey, it's a crime. A crime's a crime.
Correct. Yeah. That just was limiting. That's all that was. It just limited the amount of information they could get. And how would they know? I mean, again, you do what you do with the tools that you have at the time, but
sure.
Carol's ability to come in and start to understand a woman's perspective and calm it down and listen and sometimes not talk. Silence is powerful because then you have a chance to recall even more in those silent moments. So she used a lot of those techniques that I think really have changed the way we look at reporting crimes now, especially crimes where there are victims.
Now, you yourself said that you have reached out and are in communication with some of the other victims. Can you tell us a little bit about what is that community like? How do you help each other heal? And how do you help yourself as this person? Because I'm assuming some would want to know everything that's going on. Some may want to divorce themselves entirely, of the court case. Like, how do you help each other out? And how do you help each other cope?
So that's interesting because you have described the spectrum perfectly. There are some that are ready to, like, this man needs to go down and he needs to go down now. And then there are others who are very done. And anything that we talk about, we've had so many little hearings. It's interesting because now the energy is back around the Golden State Killer, because we've got a preliminary trial date. So the energy is really heating up again. But during the time in between his arrest, which was in April of 2018, if you can imagine, and here we are, we're going to be almost, right. Well, just over 2 years later, finally mm-hmm. going to a preliminary trial, mind you, not a real trial. This is a preliminary trial is to hold him over to trial, to show that there is enough evidence to hold him over. So there are, in those sad hearing days, they were just like 10-minute hearings too. We'd all come together, those that wanted to see each other. Some would not come to court, but would come to our after court gathering. And we've had Carol Daly's been one of the women, and another one of the survivors has had made her home open. And essentially we just go after court and hang out. And that has been some amazing times we've had. And we realize it's also probably coming to an end, as now it's going to shift again. We're going to see another shift. But what it did is it gave us 2 years to get to know one another. As you said, people have very different ways they need to live with this case, that like just for their own personal coping. But we've absolutely honored that with each other and accepted everybody on their own terms. Again, I always just say that, D'Angelo had the damn finest taste in victims, and the survivors are amazing. Like, they're just amazing people. We are very different. Some of us are extremely different. And yet together, we're still powerful, informed, courageous women. And some of these women are much older. I'm on the younger side because not only, I'm a victim of the rape and murder, but I don't have a body memory. I just lost my dad and my stepmom and kind of had a life turn that I didn't expect, but I don't have a body memory. And then I was just 18, and we were near the end of his run. I mean, in 1980, that was kind of starting to be the end. And so at least that we know of, let's put it that way, and we qualify that, please. But the idea is I'm on the younger side. So these older women who are a different generation than I, move through this differently than me and some of the other sassy young ones who are, you know, who have Me Too stories and who have been in business probably differently than our older survivors who are mostly housewives. Many of them work, but also they were housewives and they had that kind of life. And it's, you know, but we come together and it is supportive and it's funny. We tell jokes. I've written about some of the silly jokes, but you know, humor is so healing. And that's my go-to all the time is humor. So it's just, we've supported each other through all of this. We have a way we talk to one another and just share little life's advances. Because interestingly enough, we all have lives and like, we're all doing things too. So it's been amazing. I just have to, I say it all the time, but it has been amazing. And it speaks to me to the power of our humanity and our resilience and how you really can, my new tagline, how you can turn murder into lemonade, that it's possible. It's absolutely possible. You heard it here first.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, it's amazing. Again, looking at some of the interviews, I think that it was among the very first victims and something along the lines of where she was asleep with her son, I believe, yes. Right next to her. And he moved the son out of the room and then brought him in after he was done raping and attacking. And also his ability to stay in the home for such a long period of time and mentally terrorizing the person, even after he had already done the initial attack. I mean, that to me is horrendous. And to see this person, you know, 30 years from the events and her being able to tell the story with a straight face, I will tell you that I would like to think that I have that kind of strength of character. I guess maybe you find out whether you have it or not by living something through it. I hope that's not the case for anybody. But just to see that person is stoic in telling their story, and they moved on from it as best as they could. That to me, it says a lot about the human spirit, which is juxtaposed with some of the most terrible things that a human being can do.
Right. But I want to make sure that anyone listening understands, though, every one of us, even me, had dark times too. So it was absolutely growth. It was there. Some folks have drugs. Some folks have just self-abuse. You know, the things you do when you feel awful and you've experienced trauma. So it's not magic. What it has been is resilience and really fighting for your own life. You don't just fight in the moment of the crime, but then you fight for your life for the rest of your life. So that's that. I want folks to know, I don't want anybody to think, why can't I get over this? It's not how it works. You just have to decide you're worth fighting for, and you slowly start to step forward in whatever that looks like for you.
No, that's a very good point. And thank you for pointing that out. Again, that's something that some of us who have not seen anything like that may not understand. But I know, I think that's excellent. Let's go back. You said something interesting a second ago as far as, a fork in the road, for lack of a better term, in your life. So where were you? Where was your family at that time headed before it got blown to smithereens?
Yeah.
I mean, what was your track prior to, you know, to all of this?
So if you can imagine, if the camera zooms in on 1980, my dad and my stepmom lived as the crow flies about a mile away from where we kids lived with my mom. So this is in Ventura, and you can Google if you look on Google, the address of my dad's house is 573 High Point Drive. That if you look that up, you'll actually, this is kind of interesting for people that haven't looked, but if you, the one thing Google doesn't do is show you the differentiation that's happening, because it's on a hill, so it looks flat, but it is not flat. That's actually a hill, and the house that's very close behind his house, which you think, why didn't they hear something, it's actually down a hill. So there, it's that whole neighborhood is it was the first track that was being built. Now there's a lot of homes there, but that first track was just going up a hillside. You'll see behind their house, there is a what looks like it could have been a driveway. That's the green belt that D'Angelo sat on to watch their house. He could see in their house. So it's a little bit behind their house. There's just it, and I believe that's actually probably an easement for the original homestead down below to be able to put in a driveway. It just looks like might have been too expensive because it's a long driveway.
So I just want to make sure. So he was looking from above or from below?
He's sitting up on the hill. So again, you can't see this hillside on Google Earth, but you can see that he's sitting up above, and he could sit there and just watch them in their home through the back of their house. So it's 1980. I don't know when he started watching them, but we're all pretty sure that he did, because that was his MO to watch and get the lay of the land. The three kids, my brother Jay, who is two and a half years younger than I am, and then my youngest brother Gary, were all living with my mom. The plan was, my dad was well on his way to become a judge. He had been in Ventura County politics for a long time. His goal in life, I just clarified this with my mom the other day, because I go, this is what I remember, just help me make sure I'm right. But where my dad was headed in his mind was to become a senator representing California, or to become governor of California. Those were those were his two goals. And my whole life growing up was with him, was as a politician as well as a lawyer. So I was very aware he was political. When we were little kids, we would go to political events with him, you know, just like political people take their families out. We were those kids, you know, go out and have good manners, be able to work the crowd. Those were all things that we did when we were little. I think because I was the oldest, I remember it the most. My brothers don't remember it as much. They just being younger, I think birth order really was a big deal for me in terms of being able to remember a lot of this. But so he was on track. So being a judge was his first step. And then he was going to start to look into those political steps to start to move politically. And he was 48 years old. So kind of right in that sweet spot to start to make things happen.
Start to make those moves. Yeah. Yeah. And so for yourself at 18, I mean, were you?
I had just graduated high school a semester early because that's a whole long story, but because I was done. And so I had just graduated. I'd started at the junior college at Ventura, Ventura Junior College, but we called it Telegraph Tech. I don't know if they still call it that, but that's what we called it. And I was going to be going to college in the fall. That was my thing. I was getting ready to leave for school, and I had been accepted to USC. And so I thought, you know, I've got this. This is great. I'll be going to USC in the fall. It'll be great. And my brothers were going to school. I mean, it's just a regular, we just were, you know, doing regular life. That's what happened. I mean, that's what we were doing then. And then, in the middle of March, my mom came home, and there's a longer story online, but my mom came home and essentially said, "Your dad is dead." And I honestly believed that Charlene had killed him, because my dad had a license to carry, concealed carry permit, because he had done a death penalty case, and he had defended a death penalty case, and he had some other things that had scared him. And I just, it's so funny. The Reddit crowd knows I don't like guns. I get called out on that a lot, but I just don't, because I feel like that's too easy to shoot one. Like, you need to think before you do something that bad. You really need to think. That's my philosophy. But I knew my dad had that gun, and I was convinced Charlene had shot him, because I'd been up to break up some fights at the house before. And mom said, "No, Charlene's dead too." And then I just remember, like, it's like just, there's not a word for the feeling of womp. Like, just womp. You're just hit with something that your brain can't understand. And immediately, Gary wasn't with her. Gary had come in the house with her, but had to immediately run into his room, and we could tell he had been crying. So it's Jay and I standing there listening to her, kind of sitting actually. And Jay immediately said, "Okay." And then he just went running. He just left. He just couldn't process it. And he immediately went for a run. And a few minutes later, mom's like, "Can you go find him?" And I got in the car and started to go look for him, because I was the big sister. That's what I did. But that's, you know, that's kind of how it happened. It was just womp.
And so then after that, I'm assuming that your plans for college got to put on pause for a little bit, or?
Oh, not in the Smith family. No.
Okay.
No. You do what you were supposed to do. Those boys were in school the next day, because it was Monday. We went to school. I did not. So I instantly went back to my high school. I had graduated, but there is a human that I will forever thank. And his name is Bob Kuzar. And he was the vice principal at the school at that time. And for some reason, and I don't know why, but he just used his judgment. He let me hang out there that spring. He just let me come back, be with my friends. You know, you think about it now and they're like, you can't hang out at this school. But he knew, and I had been in leadership. So he knew me well. He knew who I was. He knew that my character. So I suspect he knew it was low risk to let Jenny keep running around the school. But I just hung out at that school as my lifeline because all my friends were there. And I basically dropped out of Ventura College that semester because nothing was less interesting. So that's the semester I sacrificed. I had a lot of stuff to do, too, because I was the adult next of kin. My brothers were younger. My mom had to act on their behalf, but I was the adult next of kin. So I had to do a lot of the stuff with the lawyers and with the, and right. I was a suspect for a week. So there was, my world was a different world. Like a weird stuff started happening. I'm a little pissed I was a suspect since they knew she had been raped, but okay.
I guess you just got to do a blanket view of anybody that's of age that could possibly have caused it. Now, I guess at this point in time, so this occurs. Now, he was not known as the Golden State Killer until just recently, correct?
Correct.
So prior to this, he went on, you know, by different names, the East Area Rapist, the Visalia Ransacker, the Original Night Stalker. Now, when was it connected, you know, the murder of your dad and his wife, when was that connected to anyone?
Right.
When did they know that he was part of this?
So I'm hoping to get back to Ventura to talk with folks because this is so interesting. I as I'm realizing now as this older adult that all of us had this shared experience in Ventura for about 20 years, that there was a horrific crime in a small town. We even had a preliminary trial because there was a suspect for a short amount of time. So it was a horrific crime in a small town and it hadn't been solved. But generally for those of us from Ventura, and that was our world. We weren't LA North at that point. Ventura was still Ventura kind of on its own. We just believed at some point in some way, my dad or Charlene had so provoked someone that we had this horrific murder. Because if you look at the murder scene and look at what happened here, there's a lot of feeling in that murder. This isn't an execution. This is a rage, emotional event that happened. So because my dad had been so involved in so many things, some legitimate, some not so much, and my stepmother also knew a lot of people, we suspected that they had something went wrong. Somebody got so angry. So that's for 20 years. That's what we live with. And then I had just had my daughter in 1999. And I went down as one does to show off my child to my old friends and family down in Ventura. And I said, Mom, take care of Katie. I'm going to go pop over to the police department and just find out if there's anything. I mean, 20 years doesn't hurt to check in. I've been down here in a while. When I went in, they said, we need you. The first of all, I blew them away that I just walked in, but I used to watch Rockford Files and I know that Jim Rockford would just walk in. So I do the same. And
sure.
So they said, Jenny Smith is here with just a minute. And they said, okay, we need to sit down. And I'm like, okay, do not condescend to me. I don't need to sit down. I'm not some little weak Lily, please. What's going on? And then they said, okay, this crime has been associated with, I believe it was five other murders in Southern California through a cold case investigation out of Orange County. Okay, I sat down because I knew that a serial killer getting told that the murder was a serial killer is like something, what, 0.01%? It's like doesn't even show up on a chart. It is so rare, even though that's all we hear now as consumers and as true crime fans and as people who want to understand the brains of these people, it's still somewhere at about 0.01%. It's that random and that unlikely. So I was told then that about Larry Poole and the Orange County District, Orange County Cold Case Group. And for me, a lot of folks love Paul Holes, and I too love Paul Holes, but my Paul Holes and those of us in Southern California was Larry Poole. And he and his team were amazing. And so that's when Larry said, God, I've got to get a name for this guy. So he had the moniker of the Original Night Stalker. what I love about Larry is that he's not a marketing guy. He knew he needed a catchy name, but he didn't know that it didn't probably hook the way it should have hooked. Because right. What's an original Night Stalker? I don't know what that is. Well, why do we have one? But he knew he needed a name. And so we lived with the original Night Stalker for about, and I got to go look up these dates, but I want to say somewhere between 2.5 and 3 years. And that's when I knew, you know, already now this is weird. And Ventura found this is weird. Okay, there's how random. I mean, and why Lyman and Charlene? I mean, you picked somebody that was going to get you headlines. And I don't think this guy knew it. Because he couldn't have possibly known who my dad and Charlene were in the community. And then around 2003. So this is like really three phases. Y'all just learned about this case. Got to know that like it didn't start out this way. You don't get just to wake up and have a Golden State Killer. You have to build one. So we got the connection. Then Larry was able to connect the DNA through the work they were doing down south with the investigators up north. And I don't know. There are many people who deserve this credit, and I'll blow this every time. So I am not good at who gets the credit, but I think they all do in my mind, that they put the series of murders. And I heard this on KGO radio out of San Francisco, driving home from work, that there were a series of rapes in Northern California that were now associated with a series of serial murders in Southern California. And without a call, I knew it was us. I could feel it. I get chills every time I talk about it, including right now, because I thought, oh my God, that's my whole life. And what I mean is I had gone to UC Davis. I didn't stay at USC. It was the wrong school for me. I ended up at UC Davis. My grandmother was up there in Sacramento, and she's probably my most favorite person on the planet. So and then I went to Sac State. I walked the roads this guy walked in committing these rapes. I lived in the neighborhoods where they happened, and I had never heard about it.
Yeah.
And I was at Davis in 1981, and I still never heard about the East Area Rapist. So then Larry Poole called just minutes later to confirm that, yes, I want to tell you first. I'm like, I think I know. And he's like, that's us. That's our guy. And so then I got scared. I mean, I actually really did get scared, both between when I found a serial killer, if you can imagine, as a mom with a brand new baby and finding out there's a serial killer on the loose, and then to find out he was this prolific, I was scared. Not so much that it altered my life plans, but I certainly only did things as Jenny Smith, not as Jennifer Carroll. And I wanted to make sure that Jenny Smith was always associated with Ventura and not with me living in Northern California. So, you know, I had a kid. I was a single mom by choice and didn't get married at 34. So I figured I still want a child. And so I was a little paranoid, a little bit of paranoia.
Well, understandably, because the way that I have heard is that he was known to a certain degree to taunt also, you know, past victims, to make phone calls to, you know, and so I could understand that until caught, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know.
Larry was good about telling us, like, he is, because things stopped, he's dead, he's disabled, he's incarcerated. Those were, and he would say that a lot, and I'd be like, okay, that's my mantra. He's dead, he's disabled, he's incarcerated. That's how I kept, that was my sanity. And then also, we talked about this a while back when Carol said, know how to protect yourself. I am a fierce self-defense proponent.
Sure.
For men and women. Men get bullied too. Everybody should know how they feel best about protecting themselves. If that's a weapon, fine. If that's using your body weight, fine. If that's whatever you need, do it. But just make sure in yourself, you know what you need to do to protect yourself. And so that's, you know, between Larry telling me he's dead, he's in prison, he's dead, or he's disabled, and feeling very good about protecting myself, and more my poor daughter, I made her take so many self-defense classes. But those are the kinds of things that I would do to build up my resilience against that.
It makes a lot of sense. Now, was there ever found a connection for why your family and his wife were targeted, or was it just a luck of the draw?
You know, if there's a connection, we're never going to know it, because D'Angelo's not going to talk. A lot of folks have speculated a lot of things. And the only connection that I make that is even remotely possible is that Charlene, back in the day when you had curly hair and you didn't want to have curly hair, you wanted straight hair, there were elaborate processes involved in having the straight hair. And Charlene would go get her hair done in Montecito, sure, which is up in the Santa Barbara, not Goleta, not that far up. It's down, it's in Santa Barbara, Montecito area, which I think is, I forget, it might be kind of close to where the Sanchez Domingo murder happened, but there, he possibly, and this is just about as random as being killed by a serial killer, he possibly could have seen her getting her hair done on a Thursday night and then driving back down to Ventura. That could have possibly happened. That's about the only thing. I know my dad grew up just miles from where he was arrested. My dad was a Citrus Heights kid. Both my mom and dad went to San Juan High. That's, you know, in his world up there, that's a high school that comes up. But I just, that all feels like a stretch. That just feels silly. Like that he would have to know more at that point to target them. But the serendipity of him possibly seeing Charlene getting her hair done, that could have happened. That's about it. Otherwise, I believe we'll never know why. So everyone feel free to make up your own story. Because
we don't have any conclusive answers, and he's not going to say anything.
He's not going to tell. Yeah.
Now, the day that he is captured, or the day that the match is made and you know who the guy is, what is that like for you?
Well, I didn't believe it. My friend.
It's one of those womp moments of like, yeah, what the heck are you talking?
You know, the lawyer's daughter. Just somebody give me some proof, please. I guess it was breaking in Sacramento that evening. I woke up. I was actually out of not at work that week because I'd just done a huge trade show. We had just kicked ass at a huge trade show. So I was a little bit in recovery, sleeping in, kind of catching up on sleep and that sort of thing, doing laundry, all that stuff you do when you're recovering from being at work too much. And so I get this text from my friend, Lisa, who had said they caught him. And I'm like, I don't even know what are you talking about? Why are you texting me at 7:30 in the morning? You know, that's not allowed. And so as I kind of came to, and then she gave me some links and I started to look, I thought, holy smokes, this. And then, you know, everything you might imagine, you start shaking, your stomach flips, your gut grips, like you, every physiological reaction you have when the adrenaline dumps in full on, I'm there. I'm like, what? Say again. So, sure. As I kind of came to and stumbled out to the living room and trying to figure out what's going on, the first call I made was to Ventura law enforcement. Cause I'm like, why are you people not calling me? But remember again, not many people know where Jenny Smith is at this point. You know, Larry knows where I am down in Orange County. Ventura is not following me. I'm not a thing on their radar. There's no reason for me to be. So in fact, I don't even know if they knew how to call me, but I called them and said, I need to know, is this legit? Do we have a DNA match? And I got a call. So they took the message. Great people took the message. And the district attorney called me within a few minutes, now that they had my number, and said, Jen, I want to assure you, we have 100% DNA match. Wow. And it's from DNA they found in Charlene. And I'm like, well, then we're done. I'm good. Like, this is now. And that is the moment when I realized I could finally use my real name, Jennifer Carroll, or, you know, my name since I've been an adult. I changed my name when I was 18 because the name Smith is ordinary. Everybody, no big, there was no other big reason why, other than at the time General Hospital had a character named Jennifer Smith and we were filthy with Jennifer Smith. So yes, I dropped the Smith and just went with Jennifer Carroll, but I put my name together and then essentially life as I knew it changed. Everything changed. Reporters showed up and people who knew me that didn't know called me, and my neighbor said, why are there so many reporters here? And like everything changed. And I have to say also, I was embraced by the true crime community. I didn't know, I guess because it was a way to protect myself, I didn't know what had been going on out there around this case. I just didn't. I was raising a kid by myself.
People following it and trying to crack it?
I didn't know any of that.
The people that were falling?
Yeah, I had no idea who was out there. So when I got on Twitter, like, I could almost make a list of the people who rapidly came to my aid in terms of like, here's what's going on. Here's what you don't know that's been happening while you weren't paying attention. It's like they provided the pictures in the coloring book and then started to color it in for me. amazing people out there who had followed this case and just ran in and supported me and provided me with the guideposts I needed to understand now what was really happening. Again, it's like, I have My Little Murder. Like this, we just have My Little Murder, and suddenly, boom, it's huge. No, it's massive.
It is massive. Now, I don't want to be indelicate, but I'll ask it.
Yeah.
Because I don't know this part of the history, but, you know, you talk about a DNA sample, and I have to assume that that was semen collected from your, well,
stepmother.
From Charlene.
Yeah, from Charlene, yeah.
Stepmother, sorry. I don't know. Were the rape kits being used at that point? I mean, was DNA evidence in the 1980s? I always think of it as something that's, you know,
it was
newer as far as our collection of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Look at you with all your true crime knowledge. Yes, you are absolutely right. So what had happened, and this guy is another hero, and we're going to learn more about him at the preliminary trial. I've talked to him a few times and talk about indelicate. He gets so excited about his job as a coroner investigator that he has told me things that I just never needed to know. But,
okay.
But you have to, you know, I appreciate how excited he is about it. And I appreciate the hell out of him because he had just learned, and I'm going to try myself to get the story from him verbatim, but he had just learned how to do this new kind of semen collection at a course he had taken up in San Francisco. So he was fairly young, new to the job. And what he had learned in particular was always get two samples. Always. And okay. He'll tell you in detail how he went about getting those samples. And there's a particular way to save the samples. So he was really dropping some very new knowledge on the scene at the crime scene from my dad and Charlene. And he happened to take two samples. And the reason that we have no chain of custody issues, and I just want to jump up and down on this one, because this to me, for everyone who says they're going to fight the DNA, I'm like, this one has no chain of custody issues because one of those samples sat in the freezer for these 38 years.
Wow.
I mean, wow. This man, when I meet him, he's going to get a kiss. I just love him. He's going to get a big old kiss from me because he just did what he knew was right. And look at what it's uncovered. I guess he went on to have an incredible career as being just in a remarkable, I forget his real title, but, you know, as a coroner investigator, he's very well regarded, but he's responsible for this. He's responsible for doing such a good job.
Wow. Now you have your own family. And so on the day, and this is just recently, and again, this is also what boggles the mind, is the fact that we as a society have uncovered the fact that this person was prolific in his crime period of time, and that there were so many of them. But all of a sudden, he's caught only 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the fact that people are communicating over text, you know, a lot of the serial killers that are now making the rounds on the telly as we're telling the stories and making movies about them, you know, we're talking about, you know, the fact that they were using payphones and stuff like that. And nowadays, you know, you're communicating over text as far as delivering the news. So I guess my question is, when it blows up, when he's caught, you get the news and you talk about there being news vans and reporters and media that wants to know all about it. How do you prep your own family for the onslaught of attention?
Oh, my family is so good at knowing me. So I didn't realize we would have so much media. I guess just because this time I'm in the story instead of watching the story. So I didn't really think it through or really observe, you know, because it was just happening to me in a weird way. Like I was just going with it. Our family, I've been the spokesperson for the whole time. Again, I first born, my younger brother who found my dad and Charlene does not like talking about it at all. My middle brother, he always goes, I don't have a role in this story. And I'm like, my dude, you totally have a role in this story. It's your life too. But he doesn't particularly care to talk about it either. The extrovert, that would be me, who also was, I think in a weird way, so prepped by my dad. When I realize now as an adult, my dad and I often didn't get along, but now I feel like he's right at the table with me. And so in an odd way, we had all been prepped and my brothers knew I would take the lead, and they're fine with me representing on this, because, you know, my pledge to them is I will do my best to honor Lyman and Charlene's lives, their flaws. They were human. They made mistakes, but also make sure that the story is as accurate as possible about them as I can make it, so that at least people operate with real information. My daughter is, she knows her mom well. Her mom has done many things that have gotten attention. So she has a high tolerance for her mother. So right. I adore this kid, but yeah, she has a high tolerance for me. So she handled it pretty well.
Great. Now we talked about this a second ago, and for instance, Making a Murderer, on the Netflix, or you have the Ted Bundy movie, or in movies, because there's been several, you know, that we seem to be turning the serial killer to a certain degree into a celebrity. That is the ebb and flow of our, you know, I wouldn't be surprised in 30 years from now if somebody didn't make the movie about this guy, because it's a lot of it is for sad, you know, for better, for worse. There's riveting stuff in there. There's some real stories in here.
Right.
How does somebody who has dealt with the trauma of losing family members, how do you reconcile the fact that at one point your story is not your own, that these people become available for public consumption, and that they're in that we also tend to, as a society, to make them celebrities?
Or, yeah, in some way raise them up. You're right. So it's interesting. I think a lot about this, and that's probably one of the reasons I write so much, because I just want to make sure that there are other voices in the mix. It's so human nature to be intrigued by the unusual. I mean, we started off our discussion about that, right? I share your curiosity about the minds of these people. It'll be interesting if they do this as a movie, and I suspect there will be several. I absolutely do. He's thankfully not as sexy as Ted Bundy. So,
right.
But all you got to do is cast the right person, right? So suddenly he's sexy, but that's kind of gross. But I'm okay with all of that, because first of all, I have no control over it. But I do want to make sure that there are voices out there for balance. The other thing that is really weird, and it's so funny, but the way I think of Lacey Peterson's mom, because this has happened to me, is that you're just going about your day. You're doing your thing. The murders is always in my life, but it isn't my life. And so I imagine Lacey's mom, when she goes to the grocery store and People's doing one of their People magazine gross out things where they're covering, I mean, they're trying to sell magazines, I get it, but they put Lacey's picture on the cover, and there's Lacey's mom, just went for bread and eggs, and now she's just can't breathe. That's happened to me. I think that's the hardest part, is when it hits you without warning. If you know, like HBO is working on a big thing right now. I don't know what they're going to do with it. I agreed to be interviewed. I participated. I can't talk about it. I don't know the direction of the story. There's a Chinese wall there where I'm not allowed, and it's not my purview to be involved in their creative approach.
Is this the HBO show?
Yeah, the HBO. It'll be coming out. I don't know when. I don't even know when it's coming out. I told them I'll shill it for them as soon as they tell me when, but we don't even have those dates yet. But there, right. There we go. I willingly participated, not knowing what the outcome will be, but I'm prepared. It's when you're not prepared for it that it gets you the most. And that's why I think of Lacey's mom, because it's when you're just buying your bread and eggs and you see your child on the cover of a magazine that's what knocks you over, I think, is when you just least expect it, and bam, it's right there. And it's still, there was something that was going around Twitter the other day where it had Paul Holes giving a talk, and there's my dad and Charlene on the PowerPoint behind him. And I'm like, these things still kind of are weird for me. It's weird. That's my dad. Like, but I realize now he's by hook or by crook, a public figure. And that's, And if people are respectful, I'm okay. As long as people are doing their best to be respectful, I it's okay. It's okay.
Right. And then again, I'm trying to relate, and I know that obviously I'll never, you know, understand it to the nth degree that you do. But for instance, we were talking a little bit ago about the HBO show, and if I understand it correctly, it's based from the work of Michelle McNamara. Mm-hmm. You know, now Real quick, as an aside, I'm a big Parks and Recreations fan. And Patton Oswalt was on one of the shows where he was giving a filibuster on some odd thing. And he did like this extended, what would happen if I had a if I had my way with Star Wars, this is what I would do. And it's one of the funniest things as a Star Wars fan, as a Patton Oswalt fan, as a Park and Recreation fan to hear. And I remember several months, some time ago, where he had talked about his wife dying. Mm-hmm. And you know, he wrote a very moving piece. And I knew that it was a sad situation. And I knew that she was a writer. Again, as I'm watching these documentaries, all of a sudden I see Michelle McNamara's book, In the Dark, and then there's Patton Oswalt. And all of a sudden I make the connection of like, oh my gosh, the person that who he was crying about is this the gal that wrote the book about this serial killer that I didn't know anything about, but I'm supposed to interview somebody in a couple of days. And it's all of a sudden, like these connections start firing. I'm like, how the heck did I not know? Right.
I didn't know either. By the way, I didn't know about Michelle McNamara. She never talked to us for the book. We never had any connection whatsoever.
Right. You know, so it's again, you make these connections in your own life. And here I am. And again, that's how interconnected we are. And at the same time, that's how far away we are, you know, away from things that we, you know, that are not in our everyday. Like, you know, again, it's interesting in hindsight to think, well, look at the long list of just horror that this person caused over the years, and yet different pockets of California knew something was going on, but they didn't know it was the same guy.
Right.
And here we are in modern day age, and we finally, by chance and science and some chance, now we know who it is. I mean, to me, that's amazing.
It is amazing, and that the connectedness you're speaking to, which sometimes feels like coincidence and sometimes feels like serendipity or kismet. I'm not a person who believes in fate, but I do believe in those connections. And I think for me, like when I met number one, victim number one, there's a great book. If folks haven't bought this book yet, it's on Amazon.com. It's by Kat Winters and Keith Komos. I call it the Beanie Baby Handbook of the Golden State Killer. What they have there is a compendium of every crime. And it was done, this team did it on their own. And everyone I know, every victim I know has stood behind this book saying it is the best book that lets you understand every crime. It's actually something, as this goes forward and we go to trial, if you're really into this, you might want to have this as a handbook where you can make your notes and write in the corners what you heard today or who the people are, because of course in the book they're numbers, which is, by the way, freaky. I don't even know what number. I don't think we are a number. I think we're just Ventura, but it's weird to be a number. Like, that's how many people he hurt that you get a number. It's 33.
No, number three, because it's divided, at least in the Wikipedia page. It has the rapes, and it goes all the way up to 50. And then there's the original Night Stalker.
Thank you. There we go. See, numbers. this book is fantastic, and it's a great handbook to have at your side to understand. But my point was this connectedness. When I met number one, it just happened. I was not there for the arraignment, but I went up for the second hearing. And I was just meeting people, and this woman and I had always thought about these women. Once I understood they were rapes, I'm like, God, I wish I could talk to them. Like, they understand what my stepmother went through. I wish I could talk to them to understand what happened to Charlene. Not because I wanted to know so much, but I wanted to have the compassion and the empathy for what she went through. And so I met, I guess she's actually been recorded. Her name is Phyllis. And she was on Paige St. John's podcast from the LA Times. But Phyllis, when I met her, I can't even express. There are times in your life when you just feel love, and it's not romantic love, and it's not, you know, oh my God, he's hot love. It's just love.
Right.
And when I met Phyllis, I felt that. And as it turned out, we ended up sitting, I guess she felt it back because we kind of just connected. And we ended up sitting together in the courtroom, and Phyllis is easily maybe 20 years older than me, maybe not that much, maybe 15 years older than me, but she's older. And we sat next to each other, and I noticed that she was starting to shake. So I grabbed her hand and she held on. We held hands. And then I realized that because she was there for the arraignment, or no, she had, I don't know. I forget. No, she had watched the arraignment on TV. So she was, we were all expecting D'Angelo to come out from the back of the courtroom because he would be in a wheelchair. But instead he was coming out and getting into that cage that you'll see, that you see on video. Well, Phyllis wasn't seeing that. She wasn't noticing. And so I actually had to say, just hang on. And I grabbed her hand. I said, he's coming from over here. And she was terrified because wow. She was really young when he raped her. And she's lived her whole life with this. And she really wanted to see him and didn't want to see him. And y'all know what that's like. You want to do both at the same time. And I just remember feeling so privileged to have been able to sit with her and share that with her and be there with her. And then in that moment in the courtroom for myself, I really felt like Charlene was looking at him through my eyes. I know that sounds woo-woo and weird, but it felt that personal. Like, Charlene, you can see him now. Here he is. You get to see him. And he's in the cage. It was so powerful. I like I said, ever since his arrest, my life has just changed in all good ways, but just in very powerful ways.
Now, is there an oddness as a, you know, the way that he was described during the, you know, the times of the attacks as being very lithe, very flexible, obviously could run and move about fast. He was an agile person. And here stands before you an elderly man who, you know, is walking slowly and you know, well,
you mean
old.
Acting? He was acting. Let's be clear, acting, because he was on his motorcycle just before Paul arrested him. So,
okay, there you go.
Acting, yes, it's very important.
So, do you find that does that equate that person, frail looking, frail acting, is in fact somebody who had the physicality to do these things? I mean, does that pencil?
Well, yes, he did a good job of looking pathetic. I mean, the very definition of pathetic is what he was going for, and he succeeded. It was very hard to look at him and imagine the monster that he is. But then I am convinced they could have brought anybody in. The biggest, scariest looking, I'll say banger, not to put down bangers, but you know what I mean? Like very somebody who's very, right. very hard to look intimidating. They could have brought him in, and I still think I would have had a hard time imagining that level of inhumanity. So then I backed up in my own mind and thought, this is what evil looks like. You don't know. Because and now we're back to your criminal minds point, right? Because why? How? What made you get up every day and pursue hurting people? What made you pursue studying how to hurt people and planning to hurt people and then hurting them and then reliving hurting them and calling them afterwards? Like, what in you is so broken? And as a father of three girls,
right,
a father could do this, and this is your passion in life. And I don't know that any of us could ever look at a human and understand. It's too out of the ordinary. And maybe that's what makes us good people, is that we can't understand. Maybe that's actually how we protect ourselves as humans. Because if we could understand, that would mean there's some part of that in us. It just somehow, yeah, I think it's supposed to be that we don't really understand.
Yeah, and perhaps, and that's to a certain degree the allure, because you wouldn't, you can't.
If
you're,
yeah,
right.
It's like, how, why? So it creates a whole market for true crime, because we can't understand.
Now, when do you decide, again, you know, I need to start blogging, writing, you're just, you know, and I think you covered it to a certain degree earlier before, as far as having a different voice, but how do you decide I'm going to, or maybe the better question is, how do you separate yourself as a victim of what happened in put on the writer's hat? How do you make that distinction?
So so interesting. So I've been writing forever. If anybody ever creeps my blog, because it's all up there, there's old stuff, because I've always been a writer. That's been me. I am the classic writer with 5 unfinished novels in my home. And my mother will still yell about that till the day I die, that why don't you just finish one? Because I don't know, the next thing comes along and I'm all excited. But as for writing about the case, I realized I was going to have to write. I realized there was a lot of untruth out there about my family. I like documenting how I'm thinking about things and how I'm moving it, but I don't really separate myself as I write. I do try to check myself, and I actually delight when people will question me, argue, or want to, you know, let's think about this some more, Jen. Are you really sure? You know, I like that. That's how I grew up, right? My dad was constantly asking me, well, what's your reasoning for that? Make your case. What is behind that? I like that kind of thinking. I think that's what gets us to a higher level of thinking, is when we question our beliefs or question our hypotheses. But the writing for me also, I had a friend, a very, very good friend, Teresa, who said, you know, you're writing from a point of view we've never heard from before. And I said, wait, what? And she goes, you're real time living it. You're able to articulate it. And there's no one editing you. Like, you are really telling the story from inside in a pretty non-emotional, you know, descriptive, revealing, insightful way. And I thought, when your lack of self-awareness is all in, like, wait, what? Really? I mean, I'm just writing because I can't stop myself. I can't not think about this stuff more. And so anybody who goes and reads some of my blogs, you'll find that half the time I'm up in the controversy, or I'm questioning the way the prosecution has decided to do the case, or I'm pissed because they came out with this death penalty stuff without talking to us first, or they're using the case to raise money. You know, I have a point of view. I got pissed at Patton. And unfortunately, I forgot HBO filmed that. So I suspect we'll all see that again. But I was pissed because here's this whole book about the Golden State Killer, and nobody talked to the Smith family. Like, you literally published this book without talking to us. I'm pissed. Like, I am pissed. That is not how to honor victims. That's not what you do when you publish a book. In other cases in that book, there are stories that they published that they didn't bother to vet. And so they're untrue, and specifically has to do with the Janelle Cruz murder. So, you know, my thing is, do no harm. You can write about this. You can go tell the story, but do no harm. Check your sources, go figure things out. So that's my take in writing, is I try really hard to do no harm. I try to tell the story from my kind of oddly unique point of view. I appreciate arguing. I don't call me names, but you can absolutely, I get called the libtard a lot. I'm like, yeah, I'll own that. If you knew my dad, I was raised as a Democrat. It wasn't the kind of, but again, my liberalism comes from, I'm going to tell you, it's human rights and civil rights. There you go. Don't come at me. Yeah. I'm going to fight for human rights and civil rights every time. So yeah, but even when people do that, I'm okay, because that's just who I am. It's okay with me. You can call me that. That's true. So I can't not write. And I got to say that the support I get for the writing and the feedback and the connections are, and you talk so much about it, about how, like, these 6 degrees, right? Except they're smaller. I cannot believe how many people's lives have been touched by this in ways I never knew. So when I hear those stories, it lifts me up and it connects me. And if there is a meta in all of this, it is that we are all connected, and we all do provide support to one another in ways you might not even imagine. But just reading my blog provides support, engaging in it is even more, and understanding the story and all the nuances is even more support. So I love the connection. I love the humanity.
So let's pivot on that really, really quick to your actual work, or you know, leadership coaching, because I know that that's you know, something that's a part of your, it's a big component of your website. So when did you make that turn? When did you decide that this was the way that you were going to make a difference and make a living?
It's so funny because I've always coached people my whole life. I have been told I'm an old soul and I have been here before. And so I've naturally, as a business leader, as a marketing, VP of marketing, you know, business executive, I've had teams forever. I love my teams, my people. I just love my people. And so I've often coached, I just do it. Like, it's just, it's fact, here's the hardest part about being a coach now. Like, people ask me for advice and I'm like, oh crap, I still got to do this free because these are my friends. Like, I'm never going to make money at this, is like how I hang my head down. But it absolutely came out of the evolution of the arrest. So as I started experiencing how the feedback from people that like what I wrote made a difference to them, or how I behave is an inspiration. Hey, live with that. Talk about feeling responsible. But when people say like, I watch you and you inspire me, I consider that a tremendous privilege and responsibility. So I found an amazing coaching program, and I got to tell you, the paradigm fit for me right on. It's absolutely aligned with my internal values and philosophy of life. And it has everything to do with being your best self. This coaching training, I already had a master's in communications. I'm really good at communicating in terms of business, but this idea of turning that to help people find their better selves, it just fit. It just was a natural fit. It's something that I feel very good about. I'm getting great feedback on what I'm doing in terms of the coaching itself. And I'm really excited about being able to me, it's like see one, do one, teach one, right? So if I can teach somebody something about themselves and that makes them a better person and they're able to carry that forward into the world, that's amazing. I've got a blushing right now, but that's amazing that if I can help someone be better, their better self, they can then help their kids and their spouse and their friends be their better selves. Isn't that kind of what the world needs right now? Isn't that what we're all, I mean, if you look at where we are in America, we need a lot more better selves and love and supporting and lifting each other up than we need of tearing each other down.
I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah.
Yeah. We're in a love deficit right now. It's time to build the love. And again, okay, guys, I live in Santa Cruz, little woo woo, but I'll own it. I can also argue with you, but that's it. I just want to build that energy. I want to move it forward. And coaching seemed like the absolute best way to do that. And I challenge business to bring me into their businesses, because business needs to heal thyself as well.
Yeah. Ask you more. We talked about, as far as timelines and I have to run, but I will tell you that for myself, I was very worried at the beginning of this conversation of not being tactful or of stepping on toes or to scratch at something that you've been trying to heal. And what I've come to realize during the course of our hour and a half plus that we've been talking is the fact that you are a very strong personality. You're a sprite in the best of ways. That this awful tragedy didn't stop you, and you've dealt and are dealing with the aftermath of it, but you're doing it in the best way. You're taking ownership of yourself. And to me, that's commendable.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Go ahead.
I'm just so honored you wanted to talk. And this, this is where we are. I just really thank you for this opportunity to share the story and to hopefully, if anything, inspire people to just take care of yourself. I want you to take your, lift yourself up. It's possible. I'm not saying it's fast, but it's possible.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, I will have links to your website, your blog. I'm assuming that you're all right if people nicely reach out to you on Twitter as well. And then, of course, from time to time, if there's any developments, any news on the case, I'd love to have you come back on and maybe talk for a little bit.
Absolutely.
But for me, this has been enlightening, and I hope that you and I both will be able to get a little bit of better sleep after exercising all of these demons. Jen, you have been terrific. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We'll talk again. Peace. Okay.